This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Sudan has opened a second humanitarian corridor to deliver aid to neighboring South Sudan, as the United Nations warns another 1 million people in the conflict-ridden country are on the brink of famine.
That's VOA's Jill Craig reporting. Full details on that story still ahead. Also, a surge in the number of children used in Boko Haram attacks. We speak to UNICEF to find out why. And in South Africa, opposition parties mark President Jacob Zuma's birthday with protests outside his home as they push for his resignation. We'll have these stories and more for you, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, UNICEF says there's been a rise in the number of children used in suicide attacks by the terror group Boko Haram. So far this year, there have been 27 such attacks. That's compared to 9 at the same time last year. The attempted bombings are centered in countries surrounding the Lake Chad Basin, which include Nigeria, Chad, Cameroon and Niger. Patrick Rose is UNICEF's communications specialist for West and Central Africa. Reporter William Eagle asked him what accounts for the increase in the number of child suicide bombers.
Yeah, we're seeing a huge surge in the number of suicide attacks. Girls and boys who've been abducted, they've endured years of captivity, of violence, of sexual violence, and some of them, as Boko Haram is kind of defeated on the battlefield, are being sort of forced into this horrific practice of being used as so-called suicide bombers.
The Nigerian government says they have Boko Haram on the run, at least within Nigeria. Are most of these attacks happening within the country or in the country's peripheral to Nigeria around the Lake Chad Basin?
In previous years, the attacks have been spread more evenly across other countries, including Cameroon and Niger. What's disturbing about this sort of recent spike in attacks has been that it's been entirely concentrated in northeast Nigeria. Out of those 27 attacks, they have been all of them this year in northeast Nigeria. The more you have these sort of attacks, the more difficult it becomes to deliver supplies and get experts and specialists to the right place to build water systems or schools and so on. So the more that you get these attacks, the more and more acute the suffering of people is within this kind of humanitarian crisis.
UNICEF notes that girls are increasingly using these attacks. Why girls rather than boys?
You know, one can only suspect that girls are less sort of threatening at military checkpoints, that they are able to sort of slip more easily undetected through different sort of civilian areas, markets and mosques and so on, without raising the alarm of military or some of the local militias who are on the lookout for, quote-unquote, Boko Haram fighters.
Hundreds of children are retained and then vetted by authorities upon their release. Why is it important to move released children from a military to civilian environment as soon as possible?
UNICEF has consistently been calling for these children not to be held in any form of administrative custody, but to be released immediately to civilian authorities if there is sort of information that needs to be sort of determined about what information they have that might help in the fight against Boko Haram. Well, then that can be done under the custody of civilian authorities. Because what needs to happen is these children have been through unspeakable horror. They haven't had access to medical care or education. And so it's essential that they're moved quickly to civilian authorities so that UNICEF and its partners can start to provide all the different wraparound services for these children to access these things. But this is really just the first step before we start to sort of open up a discussion to try to reunite them with their family. And that's a really complicated process that requires a lot of sort of patient, sort of peace-building work in order to sort of recognize that there are sort of certain stigmas attached to it within these communities, and we need to work with those communities to reduce that discrimination and that stigma, that knee-jerk reaction.
You mentioned stigma. What steps does UNICEF take to reduce stigma?
Yeah, it's really interesting as you travel around northeast Nigeria into any number of the IDP camps, the camps for internally displaced people. You can see that there's a lot of abandoned buildings in many places, and the children take the ashes or the sort of charcoal from the fire and draw all over the walls. And those drawings are really a study within sort of nightmares and, you know, their sort of processing of what's happened to them, some of the violence that they've seen, some of the horrors that they've seen. So I think that it's safe to say that all the children who've been displaced have very similar stories of loss, of violence, of displacement, and of this very difficult process of being displaced and living in these camps. You know, most alarming is what's happened to the boys and girls who've been associated with Boko Haram, is that they keep that secret, because they don't want to sort of invite the comments or the gossip or the rumors or even the violence from other members of the camp who may be distrustful of somebody who's been associated with Boko Haram. So it's crucial that we sort of foster a dialogue, get the community to start talking about it, recognizing that these are children, they are not terrorists, they are not extremists, that they are victims of Boko Haram.
UNICEF's Patrick Rose there speaking from Dakar with reporter William Eagle. Nearly 500 people have died from a meningitis outbreak in northern Nigeria. Most of the victims are children. In all, more than 4,000 cases have been recorded, and health officials have now launched a public awareness campaign to prioritize prevention. They're also trying to manage a serious shortage of the costly meningitis vaccine. Chika Odua reports from Abuja.
A rare strain of meningitis has claimed 489 lives in Nigeria. Those are the latest statistics released Tuesday by Nigeria's Center for Disease Control. The majority of the victims have been children aged 5 to 14. The outbreak began in December and is hitting the country's poor northern region the hardest. Dr. Chikwe Ihekweazu is the head of Nigeria's Center for Disease Control.
Meningitis was fairly rare in our context until 2013, 2014, thereabouts. Meningitis A was the predominant serogroup by a lot, a huge margin, all over West Africa. It's a fairly serious one. For this particular strain, we found it in 5 states only.
Those 5 states are in northwestern and north-central Nigeria. The deaths have primarily happened in impoverished communities with little access to hospitals. Families in these areas are often polygamous with several children. Relatives live packed into small shacks where there is little ventilation. Meningitis A and C are bacterial infections spread by saliva and close physical contact. The infection inflames the brain and spinal cord. The capital, Abuja, in central Nigeria, has also reported 6 suspected meningitis deaths. And Niger State, which neighbors Abuja, has reported 16 confirmed cases. Health authorities in Abuja have administered more than 70,000 doses of meningitis A and C vaccine. Dr. Rwanu Mohammed is working with the city's primary healthcare board on its vaccination campaign.
When we heard about the outbreak, we started collecting and we started vaccinating as well. We are very careful because this is Nigeria's capital territory. So people are coming in and out. It's about 9.5% growth rate. So it's really a big place that infection can be transmitted easily.
Dr. Rwanu says the board is targeting high-risk populations, like people who have fled their homes in northeastern Nigeria in fear of Boko Haram. About 65,000 of them are now in Abuja, living in camps across the city.
We vaccinated all of them because we realize that they are the most at risk. Our intention now is actually to vaccinate the people in prisons, and we also wanted to reach the level of the Nigerian army in barracks. We're targeting slums, we're targeting even some motor parks, because anywhere there's overcrowding.
But meningitis vaccine is expensive and there is a global shortage. The allocation given to Abuja ran out about a week ago. This year, the World Health Organization gave Nigeria 500,000 doses of the meningitis A and C vaccine. But that stock is nearly gone. An additional batch of about 800,000 more doses of conjugate meningitis C vaccine from the British government is expected any day now. Most of that will be deployed to the northwestern state of Sokoto. Zamfara State, which is the epicenter and origin of the outbreak, says it needs 3 million doses. The head of Nigeria's Center for Disease Control says the high cost of the vaccine is unacceptable.
So if we had all the currently available global stock of vaccine, it will not be enough to provide immunity for Nigeria alone. And we really need to plan more aggressively. But we need the world to help us, and we need to increase global production and reduce prices. The best vaccine we have at the moment, the polyvalent conjugate vaccine, costs close to $50 a dose.
The polyvalent vaccine would provide protection for various strands of meningitis. But Dr. Chikwe Ihekwuazu of Nigeria's Center for Disease Control says more resources are needed to get medicines to the regions most affected by the disease.
It is simply unaffordable for Nigeria and many countries in West Africa. So we really need to find the resources to work together with our partners, with other countries, to say, listen, the region in the world most affected by MNC can't be deprived of the vaccines because of cost in 2017.
The 2015 outbreak of meningitis C killed 1,100 people and sickened more than 10,000 in Nigeria and neighboring Niger. Health workers met Tuesday with traditional rulers to talk about prevention. Northern Nigeria's traditional Islamic rulers wield enormous influence. Many people trust them over government officials. These rulers have been instrumental in dispelling false myths about the polio vaccine, which has helped to dispel resistance to vaccination and eradicate polio in the north. With meningitis vaccine in short supply, health workers hope to enlist these rulers' help in educating communities on prevention. Chika Odua for VOA News, Abuja.
In other news from Nigeria, more than 200 electoral commission officers have been suspended for taking bribes to try to influence the 2015 election. AFP reports the staff members were found guilty of corruption following an investigation by the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, which is an anti-graft agency. The suspended INEC staffers will receive half their pay while a final determination of their cases is made. At least 70 of them will be investigated further for possible prosecution. The investigation found they took about $9.5 million in bribes in the 2015 vote, in which then-incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan lost to opposition candidate Muhammadu Buhari. Sudan has opened a second humanitarian corridor to deliver aid to neighboring South Sudan. This as the United Nations warns another 1 million people in the conflict-ridden country are now on the brink of famine. VOA's Jill Craig is in Nairobi with this report.
As South Sudan reels from conflict, famine, and food insecurity, neighboring Sudan, in collaboration with the World Food Program and Government of South Sudan, recently opened a second humanitarian corridor to help deliver food and nutrition support. The first convoy of 27 trucks carrying about 1,200 metric tons of cereal went through earlier this month. Chalice McDonough is a senior regional spokeswoman at the World Food Program.
This is a transport corridor that has recently been opened up between El Obeid in Sudan and Bentiu in South Sudan that we are hoping to use to move some 10,000 metric tons of food until the roads become impassable once the rainy season starts in June or July. That would allow us to continue to pre-position enough food in Bentiu that will help us provide food and nutrition support to about 220,000 people.
This is the first corridor into Unity State, but since mid-2014, the World Food Program has been using another corridor from Sudan to Upper Nile State in South Sudan, with supplies going by road or barge. McDonough says 7 convoys have come through this corridor this year, bringing enough food to benefit about 200,000 people. She adds that security concerns mean food cannot be taken by road to the famine-stricken areas of Unity State.
So Lir and Mayandit are places that right now we could not store food for any length of time. So we are using this kind of rapid response model. We've got emergency teams that go in, that do food distributions. We supply them by airdrop. Because it's just sort of extreme levels of insecurity, conflict, and the lack of road infrastructure.
The vice president of programs and government relations for U.S.-based charity Samaritan's Purse, Ken Isaacs, says bringing food from Sudan is a good idea, but he notes a discrepancy, since Khartoum restricts aid to its own South Kordofan and Blue Nile states.
So I wish that the government of Sudan would offer the same humanitarian access that they have now offered benevolently to South Sudan. I wish that they would offer it to the two areas. In other words, that food could be brought up from South Sudan.
Attempts to reach Sudan's foreign minister and government spokesman for response were unsuccessful. Save the Children's South Sudan Program Director of Policy and Advocacy, Joseph Akesh, says the corridor will help his organization.
And if there is a humanitarian corridor which comes with other services in terms of food to those communities, it will enhance our programming where that will reduce the burden we have to deal with at the moment.
The Norwegian, British, and U.S. governments released a joint statement welcoming Sudan's decision and urged all armed groups to allow full and safe humanitarian access to reach communities in need and to ensure that food and other commodities are not diverted from the intended beneficiaries. More than 365,000 South Sudanese refugees live in Sudan. Among the more than 1.7 million South Sudanese refugees and asylum seekers who have fled to neighboring countries. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick in Washington. At 22 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. A worrying report from UNICEF shows a rise in the number of children used in Boko Haram suicide attacks. Sudan opens a second humanitarian corridor to deliver aid to neighboring South Sudan, where another 1 million people are now on the brink of famine. And tens of thousands of South Africans mark President Jacob Zuma's birthday with protests against him as they push for his resignation. For more news and information, please visit our website at voaafrica.com. Eight Indian sailors who were captured by Somali pirates on April 1st have been rescued by security forces. VOA's Somali service says the sailors had been held near the village of Dugule in the Mudug region. Two other sailors were rescued aboard their ship on Monday. They are reportedly safe and with security forces. Four suspected pirates have been detained. Moving to South Africa now, where pressure is mounting on embattled President Jacob Zuma. Opposition parties led demonstrations outside his home Wednesday. They're pushing for his resignation in the wake of corruption scandals, a controversial cabinet reshuffle, and the country's mounting economic woes. As Anita Powell reports from Pretoria, the latest protests come as Zuma faces a no-confidence vote in Parliament next week.
A celebratory atmosphere hung over President Zuma's home on this, his 75th birthday. Tens of thousands of South Africans donned bright colors and marched Wednesday to his official residence in central Pretoria, singing and dancing as they made their way through the streets. They were not bringing birthday wishes. They were asking the increasingly unpopular leader to leave. 7 major opposition parties organized the march at Pretoria's Union Buildings and said they will continue to loudly and peacefully protest Zuma for the duration of his term, which is set to end in 2019. the president has earned many critics for long-simmering corruption scandals. But his decision last month to fire a well-respected finance minister and reorganize his cabinet prompted those critics to call for a nationwide shutdown and protests on Friday. The opposition has called for a no-confidence vote in Parliament next week. Protester Tsebele Bapela, 35, a supporter of the far-left Economic Freedom Fighters Party, said the long-ruling African National Congress, the party Zuma leads, is his true target.
I don't only want Zuma to resign, but what I'm calling for the ANC to leave. ANC is not in the interest of the people of South Africa. ANC is not in the interest of the poorest of the people of South Africa.
Like Bapela, many people in the mostly black crowd refuted Zuma's claims that those who stand against him are racists. A florist who gave only her first name, Bongiwe, said she does not identify with any particular political party and accused the president of race baiting.
He sows division by always playing the race card to suit his own plans and ambitions. So we don't buy it. As black people, we also have... we believe in ethics. We know what's right and what's wrong. We believe in accountable government. We are anti-corruption. You know, it's not a white thing. It's not a black thing. It's a human thing. It has nothing to do with color. So really, Zuma, your time is up.
As tens of thousands of participants sang, danced, blew vuvuzelas, and created a party-like atmosphere on the lawns of the president's home, one of the youngest protesters, six-week-old Jan, slept through the whole thing. His mother, 38-year-old Susanna Hutton, said she felt strongly that she needed to interrupt her maternity leave to peacefully protest Zuma.
He's the main leader and he doesn't lead by example. And it seems like everything that filters down is led by him in terms of the breakdown of the country.
Zuma did not make an appearance before the crowd, choosing instead to meet in Soweto with supporters, many of whom had been bussed in from other provinces where he remains popular. In a statement, Zuma's office said his birthday wish is to see more progress being made in building a better life for the poor and the working class. Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria.
At the end of last year, 283 people in southern African countries were on death row. But Amnesty International says only one of those countries actually executed an inmate. It says Botswana hanged a 65-year-old man for the 2010 murder of an elderly man. Amnesty says 110 inmates were sentenced to death in Malawi, Zambia and Zimbabwe in 2016. Most were in Zambia. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18 UTC. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thank you for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I am your host Shaka Sali. Every Wednesday night, the Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the Anglophone crisis in Cameroon. The nation's English-speaking minority regions say they are being politically and economically marginalized by the Francophone government. Cameroon politics, an in-depth discussion on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30. UTC.
Hello, I'm Douglas Mpoga, host of Reporters Roundtable. Join us this week as we discuss the corruption in Africa. I'll have a panel of journalists and analysts this Thursday at 17:30 UTC. Right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa.
VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.